Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of the FIEC, and taking a break from our conference planning, being just a week out from the Leaders Conference, is our National Director, John Stevens. Hello, John.
Hi, Phil.
And Adrian Reynolds, our Associate National Director. Hello, Adrian. How are you?
Well, hello. I'm very well.
We are literally a week out. Lots going on. We're really excited for the Leaders Conference, though, aren't we? 1,100 bookings, I think we're up to now. Fantastic numbers.
That's exactly right. And we're basically full.
Yeah.
And we'll need to think about that for next year. And I'm really pleased about that because it's such an important subject, world mission. And when we planned it, I was perhaps a little bit more pessimistic that people might not think this is an important subject. But actually, it's not only good for leaders to get together. I mean, that's the primary reason we have a leaders conference, to spend time together, encourage one another. But actually, we're tackling a really important subject and some really exciting stuff. I've had a trail. You know, like watching the trailers on Netflix. I've had a little trailer of some of the sessions and they are top quality, I'll tell you.
We are really, really looking forward to it. It's worth saying, by the time you're listening to this, bookings will have closed. So this is coming out on Reformation Day, Halloween, 31st of October. We have now closed bookings. But John, it's really encouraging to see so many people gathering with us in Blackpool.
Oh, absolutely. And I think having a heart for world mission and particularly wanting to come together for an add-on event about intercultural ministry as well, I just think that shows that this is an area that our churches and their leaders are really concerned about. Many are involved in world mission. They support missionaries. I think we want to have this bigger vision of the work of God in the world. And of course, the massive need in our own country. People who are not Christians, we still think 2-3% are believers. There are many who come from different religious communities and backgrounds. About 6.5% of the population come from a Muslim background, about 1% from a Hindu background. Those are in many ways unreached communities within our country. And we want to think about how do we reach them with the gospel. I'm speaking about what God is doing around the world at the Leaders Conference. I was chatting about that with Adrian this week.
You've got 45 minutes, John.
I have.
But you've probably got eight hours of material, I think.
I think it's just immensely encouraging to think about the progress of the gospel around the world, particularly over the last century. It's so easy for us in the UK, I think, to be discouraged. We think about our situation. We feel small. We feel that we've experienced significant decline. And we are. But we can easily lose sight of the way that God has been at work in absolutely remarkable ways in reaching people around the world. The massive growth of the church over the last century is extraordinary. So I think I would hope that we will be both excited to be part of the Great Commission, but also massively encouraged.
How many people are born again, would you say? You know, we can't say, we can't send to people's hearts. Roughly how many people would be born again believers in the world?
I think something like 633 million or something like that, evangelicals in the world. There are other Christian groups, about 2.6 billion Christians. It's quite hard to tease out how many of those are all exactly believers.
But you think back to that.
Massive.
Think back to the upper room.
Yeah.
Before Pentecost, where they locked the doors and gathered to pray, and from there to here, it's extraordinary, isn't it? It's just absolutely
remarkable growth.
I think actually, I mean, in the beginning of the time when the church started, it's estimated there were no more than 170 million people in the entire world. So the numbers of Christians alive today are way bigger than the total population of the world.
It blows your mind.
Back in the first century. And yes, the numbers are huge. And statistics, it's hard to be precise, but the numbers, even if they're not entirely accurate, do at least reveal massive trends, and they are hugely encouraging.
Our intercultural ministry advisor, Justin Gill, has been at the World Evangelical Alliance in South Korea this past week, and he was saying something of just the encouragement of stories from around the world when he joined us in the evening over in South Korea for our prayer.
It's one of the reasons we're going to tell some stories at the Leaders Conference, because I think the problem is when we're in, you know, you in your small corner and I in mine, that kind of philosophy, actually we do end up being discouraged because things do seem slow, and we sort of hold on to, you know, one baptism or one conversion. Of course, every conversion story is a miracle, but actually around the world there are some remarkable things happening, and we do need to rejoice with those who rejoice.
And one of the things that FIEC is investing in terms of growth here is in church planting and in training. Adrian, just tell us what's coming up in the new year.
Well, two events that are happening quite early on in the new year that are worth marking your card with. So first of all, Journeys, which is our conference, our weekend for those who are considering ministry or just taking the first steps into ministry.
Heavily subsidised.
Heavily subsidised to get people along. Most churches, I think every church could afford to send somebody. If you've got someone in your church who's thinking about ministry, you'd love to get them to get some input and for them to have some time to reflect and pray and think, then do send them along to Journeys. We'd love to see them. We'd love to serve them well. It's been a great part of our training initiative really over the last few years in its different forms. So we're very excited about that. And planting, there's always a need to be thinking about planting and to encourage church planters. It can be a lonely, hard thing to be a church planter. And so our planters conference kicked off for the first time this year, 2025. And next year it will be at the end, is it the beginning of February, isn't it? Is that right? 2026, do come along for that.
We'll put links in the show notes to both of those anyway. And I'm wearing my Rising Lights hoodie, John, which is very exciting. So we've got 1,500 bookings now, 1,500 adults and children coming to Rising Lights. Really excited for that. And we'll be talking a bit about that at the Leaders Conference in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. This is our new Easter event. It's filling the space where Word Alive was. I think it's a wonderful opportunity for people in churches or evangelicals to come together for encouragement, for great Bible teaching. Paul Mallard is giving the Bible readings, whole range of seminars touching on all different aspects of the Christian life, our culture, how to engage, worship in the evening that will lift our hearts, fantastic kids' work being provided by Growing Young Disciples. We're delighted UCCF are partnering with us to run a track for kind of our 19s to 24s to come along. They've got reduced prices to enable them to come. There's lots of accommodation options in Torquay, whether it be in hotels that are near the conference centre or Airbnbs or caravans. So there's loads of ways to be able to come and enjoy the event. So we'd love to see you there.
Really excited for Rising Lights. £160 for adults, £40 for kids and £100 for the student price or the 19s to 24 price. So do book your place now if you haven't already. Brothers, we are here to talk a bit about what's been going on in the news. So why don't we do that for a couple of minutes? There have been lots of stories this past week or 10 days about immigration, migration, integration of different cultures in our community. Let me just list two or three of them and then we'll talk around them a little bit. So we saw the story of a convicted sex offender who was released from prison early and then deported back to Ethiopia. Just this last couple of days, an Afghan man who arrived illegally in Britain and was later granted indefinite leave to remain. He was charged with murdering bin man Wayne Broadhurst in Uxbridge. We heard from Reform MP Sarah Potchin complaining that adverts are unrepresentative of British society. That sparked claims of racism. She says that was not her intention. It does just feel like we are seeing in all of these different stories a polarisation in our nation. Which side are you on is the question that is being asked. And it's becoming increasingly fraught, and particularly in the social media space. I don't want to talk really about any of these stories individually, though of course they all have merit for discussion. But really I want to talk about, as church leaders, how do we lead in light of that, given that these polarizing opinions are going to be making it into our congregations?
I think one of the key things we've got to do, Phil, is get people to think about principles and not just stories. Stories are very engaging, but often they are describing particular situations in very unusual circumstances, or frankly, are spun a certain way, one way or the other, to support one position or another. And when you start to dig into the details, you discover they're not quite they were. So there was a story not that long ago about someone who was being deported because they didn't like the nuggets, or was staying in the country because they didn't like the nuggets in the country where they were being deported to, which turned out not to be the case, but it kept getting repeated by politicians again and again. Now, I don't want to comment on that story either, but what I think that happens is people latch onto headlines, they latch onto the first paragraph of a story that they've read on a website that will support their position, whatever that position is, and that then becomes their position. I think what we've got to help church members do, and what we've got to do as leaders actually, is think about things from first principles. Think about what do we think about these subjects in a principled and biblical way. And people will come to different conclusions, I think, but I'm okay with that if people have thought about it biblically and in a principled way. I think what we end up doing is we end up chasing headlines and chasing stories. You've just listed some of them. And some of those stories themselves can be spun in different ways, depending on what line you take. So, you know, the Ethiopian guy tried to hand himself into police, he claims, and the police weren't interested. Well, there's another spin on that story if you want to take that one. So each of the stories has a particular spin, depending on your position. So the stories are important and they involve real people. It's always worth remembering that.
Real victims as well.
Real victims, real people. But I think we've got to try and get beyond the stories, if you like, and say, you know, what do we think about these subjects in a principled way, in a biblical way? I don't find that a very easy thing to do because the stories keep coming at you. You're bombarded by them. What position do you take? What do you think about this? What do you think about that? What? And I sometimes just want to say, hey, slow down. Let's think about what the issues are.
So how do we facilitate what are difficult conversations?
Well, I think one of the real challenges here is, and obviously at the moment, the issue of immigration, particularly illegal migration, but also the scale of legal migration, is a massive political issue.
Yeah.
That there is a massive public discontent with the large-scale immigration that's been allowed. I think it's perfectly legitimate for people to be concerned about that, to ask questions as to whether that is sustainable, whether the infrastructure resources can meet sort of large-scale immigration, the impact on particular communities and cultures of bringing people who have a very different set of values. So those are, I think, perfectly legitimate concerns. At the same time, of course, our economy has needed people to come and work in it, and many care homes, hospitals, the NHS, agricultural work has required migrants to come and work in those areas. So we need to kind of bear in mind the other side of the story as well. But I think in the midst of all of that discussion of what is a big public issue, there is a great danger that the rhetoric becomes ever more intense. I think as leaders, we've got to be very careful about the rhetoric that is used and not stoking that. So yes, there are stories of illegal and illegal migrants, asylum seekers who've committed terrible crimes. We mustn't forget there are also plenty of people in the UK who are perfectly legally in the UK and people who are not migrants at all who commit terrible crimes. It's easy to blame particular groups. So there's been much focus on the Pakistani grooming gangs. There was a conviction this week of a Romanian grooming gang in Glasgow that was engaged in exactly the same behaviour. So I think we need to be able to calm the rhetoric on some of these issues and to model how can you speak about them in an appropriate way. I think the comments that were made about adverts and whether they're representative or not wasn't just an objection on the part of the MP to the adverts. The language that was used was she said that she was made mad by seeing black and Asian people on British television. And others have sort of wanted to say that language was wrong. They've tried to defend it as not racist, but that's exactly the example of the kind of rhetoric that is used that at least seems to imply attitudes towards people of other races. And I think that there's much of that in our culture at the moment. We need to recognise that's true outside of the church. It may sadly be true inside the church. And I think one of the things that worries me is people within the church perhaps feeling that language that would have been regarded as being racist can now be normalised and be used. I think we need to be willing to challenge that and not exploit it for our own purposes. So I think we need to teach the truth and we need to maintain a proper proportion and balance and keep remembering that the gospel objectives, what the gospel is concerned about, isn't just solving political problems. We are first and foremost those who are gospel ministers wanting to win people to Christ and to eternal salvation. And we mustn't lose the focus on that as the priority of what our ministry is.
I wonder too, Philip, we've got to detach macro issues from micro issues. Now, what I mean by that is the macro issues are, you know, what do we think about immigration? What do we think about what the appropriate numbers should be? What do we think about indefinite leave to remain and what the rules should be on that? What do we think about the European Court of Human Rights? Those sort of macro issues. And obviously, they cash out in how they affect individuals. But for us as churches, we're embedded in communities where there are individuals from all kinds of probably different backgrounds. There may be asylum seekers. We may have an asylum seeker hotel, for example, or accommodation or house of multiple occupation next door to where you live or next door to where the church is. And I call that a micro issue. At that point, I think it's not about macro. What do I think about asylum? And whether these people, sorry, I'm putting my fingers in the air, sort of inverted commas, should be here or not. They're the people who live next door to me. And actually, I've got a responsibility to the people who live next door to me. I'm to love my neighbour. So I think where this cashes out is at a micro level. We have to detach kind of the macro principles from that and think about what does it mean to show the love of Christ to those around us? How do we share the gospel with those around us? How do we show kindness to those around us? And we can still have a proper debate about the macro issues and differ, I think, on the macro issues. But I think there's much less room, it seems to me, to differ on the micro issues and on how we deal with our neighbours in a way that's gracious and Christian.
Differing on the macro issues isn't always straightforward for church leaders, though, to engage with that in the church, because there might be that difference, but suddenly it becomes really difficult to know how to help people to get along when they don't share the same views. Am I overreaching, John? Is that fair?
Well, no, I mean, you would expect within the Christian church, if we're drawing people from a wide variety of cultures and different positions, people will have different political views. There's a danger of churches just gathering people solely of one particular political view, which suggests that the ministry is then shaped in a very political way. But if we're primarily going to be Jesus-centered, then one would think that in our churches we will gather people who have a spectrum of different views, who vote in different ways, for whom issues are different issues. And as leaders, we need to be very aware of that. I think that's one of the dangers.
Even amongst leaders, that might be true in your church.
We've got to be very careful not to make our personal political agenda equivalent to the gospel agenda. And that involves a large measure of self-restraint on the parts of those who are in leadership. And I think we also, within our churches, we need to remember that in many of our churches have people who have migrated to the UK, asylum seekers who've been granted asylum or are seeking asylum, many who have been from migrant families that have been in the UK for multiple generations. We need to be very careful to think about how the way we speak or how other Christians speak affects them. So I think there are those who are hearing the message, you're not really wanted here, you're not really welcome, you ought not to be here. And in the church family, and Christians can inadvertently communicate that because of the intensity of their emotions about some of these issues. And again, as leaders, I think we have to challenge that. So you see in the New Testament, the challenge of Jews and Gentiles coming together, Jews using language of Gentiles, describing them as dogs and having that very negative perception. And then suddenly people come into the church, or of describing certain groups of people as barbarians, kind of uneducated. Well, the gospel goes out to all kinds of people, and those sort of human attitudes to others need to be subverted by the gospel.
Mm. We're seeing a lot of flags around. Yep. Any place for flags in church?
You're asking me that?
Well, why not? Yeah, put you on the spot. Or John?
So some of our churches that have got a hugely intercultural ministry, so Harper Church in Glasgow, Alan McKnight's one of the speakers at the Leaders' Conference, they've got the flags of all the nationalities represented in the church.
Slightly different issue.
But it's interesting, isn't it? So they are taking pride in all those flags because they're gathering together from around the world. Yeah. So I don't have any problem with seeing British flags around, personally. I'm British. I don't have any problem with that.
On the streets, yes, I'd be concerned about them being in church. I mean, I think at one level, at church, we are wanting to focus on the kingdom of God, kingdom of heaven. Mm. We're not associated with one particular nationality. I think there's a sort of a danger, again, of in a sense seeing the gospel as bound up with the interests of one particular nation. Mm. And actually, that's where there's a danger that it flows over into a kind of an idolatry of nation or a distortion of the gospel that flows from that. And I think that's why there needs to be a sort of a distinction between the work and ministry of the church and the life of a local church. And that's a theological conviction that for me reflects the fact that there are separate kingdoms, the kingdoms of this world and the kingdom of God. And it seems to me that it's always problematic when those two get confused with each other.
I think this is right. I can be corrected if not, that when Mark Dever went to Capitol Hill, he took the Stars and Stripes down. Which is quite a thing to do in Capitol Hill.
And that's not to say we shouldn't be concerned about our nation. Of course we should. Or our rulers. We're commanded to pray for those who rule us. We're commanded to pray for peace.
We're commanded to be good citizens.
Ask that they would serve. We're to be good citizens. So that is not the same as saying we have no concern for our nation. But it's putting it in its proper place, and it's recognising that as church, our concern is with the kingdom of God. That's the nation that we belong to, ultimately. Mm. And in church, we're seeking its interest and its advance.
Talking of nation.
Well, yeah.
So, yeah. See what I did there, Phil?
I like
that. I worked hard for you.
I should just say, I'm not advocating British flags in churches. I'm just saying I have no problem seeing the British flag in Britain.
That's you go to Corby, which is just next door. Yeah. It's Scottish flags.
Because there's lots of Scots in Corby. Yeah.
I mean, the thing about flags is it depends what they mean in the context in which they're used. So if we are at war with somebody, a flag becomes a gathering point for national unity in a conflict like that. But where a flag is used to basically say, I belong and you don't, then that's actually conveying something very different. So what use is made of a flag and what's intended to be conveyed by it is actually hugely
significant. No FIC flagpole just yet then.
No, not just yet. But we're going to talk about what it means to be head of state in the nation.
Can we?
We're going to talk about King Charles. So it is Reformation Day today, All Hallows Eve. King Charles has, in this past couple of weeks, travelled to Vatican City, and he has prayed with the Pope. So the head of the Church of England praying alongside the Pope, head of the Catholic Church. The first time that's happened in that way in over 500 years.
They took the Archbishop of York with them.
Yeah, there we are. And similarly, in a different stance, he has been to a Hindu temple, wished everybody a happy Diwali. How do we respond to this? We are Protestants, obviously. The Protestant Truth Society said this in a letter to the King. His Majesty made a promise before God to maintain the Protestant Reformed religion. A promise made before God is of utmost importance. This visit to the Vatican is a breach of that promise. How do we respond as independents?
What's the next story we've got?
Well, I'm not sure that it's quite right to say that meeting with the Pope, even in the service, is the same as breaking a coronation oath to maintain the Reformed religion. The Church of England still retains its position as the state religion of the UK. It's not as if Catholicism has been introduced as the state religion. So I think there's a question of precisely what does that coronation oath mean. But actually, the bigger question is the implication that the Reformation no longer matters, and there's no real difference between the Protestant Church and the Roman Catholic Church, between the Anglican Church and Roman Catholicism. Now, at one level, the King going is not the moment at which that sort of setting aside of the Reformation has occurred. I mean, the late Queen met five popes in the course of her reign, so there have been meetings with popes. The Anglican Church has been in a process of engagement with the Catholic Church. I think that it was Archbishop Robert Runcie who prayed with Pope John Paul II. They held a joint service in Canterbury Cathedral in 1982. So at one level, the spiritual leaders of the Church of England have already engaged in that process with the Roman Catholic Church. And of course, for lots of people, they think that these churches ought to be visibly united. Actually, Archbishop Cottrell basically on an interview made the point that he was looking forward to the complete visible unity of the Church of England and the Roman Catholic Church, that's what they're aiming for. So I think that ought to be a matter of concern. The Reformation recognised there were massive differences between Roman Catholicism and the true biblical faith, that they represent very different modes of salvation and how the good news of Christ is enjoyed and received by people. The reformers were of the view that the Roman Catholic Church was an apostate church because it was no longer teaching the gospel in a biblical way. And in fact, the Roman Catholic Church at the time of the Counter-Reformation denounced most Protestant doctrines as inconsistent with the Bible and anathematized them. That has never been withdrawn. Mm. For all the discussions there have been, basically the Roman Catholic Church anathematizes what we would believe as Protestants and evangelicals. So the Reformation still remains a fundamental division within kind of world Christianity. And I think that the Roman Catholic Church continues to teach doctrines and a model of salvation which is contrary to what the Bible says. Now, that's not to say that individual Roman Catholics are not necessarily Christians. There are those who believe truly in Jesus, even though they've been wrongly taught and may be deceived by the church. But it's vitally important to recognize that there is that absolute difference in an understanding of how you get right with God and how salvation is received, and that is a crucial sort of issue. That's why the FIEC has always taken the view that we cannot engage in joint services, prayer, evangelism, worship with those who would deny what we think are core gospel doctrines.
Yeah. I'm going to issue seven words I never thought I would say in public. I have some sympathy with the King.
Just get that out. Can we clip it?
Yeah. His head of state, as well as being head of the church, and it's an impossible situation to be in. I mean, you were saying earlier, John, 6.5% of the population are Muslims. Charles is their king. 1% of the population are Hindus. Charles is their king. And many more don't share Christian faith. Charles is their king. So he's trying to be head of state, or is expected to be head of state and head of the church. And one of the reasons I'm an independent is because I don't think those two things can go together. Mm. Robert Strivens did a very good session at the Leaders Conference a few years ago. We'll put the link in the show notes, talking about the history of independency. And he said it was birthed out of not being independent from one another, but birthed out of being independent from the state. Precisely because we saw that
we
didn't want that interference, and we saw that that was the only way to maintain a pure church. And actually the data backs that out. So there are some great congregations in the Church of England, and the Church of England doctrine is of course Protestant, and yet there are lots and lots of Anglo-Catholic almost full-on Catholic churches within the Church of England. I went to went inside a famous church. We were in Chesterfield on holiday just for a couple of days last week, the one with the twisted spire.
Crooked spire.
And we went inside, and just on one side, there is a massive slab that's been laid into the floor in the last 5 years, which obviously they needed permission to do in an old church, which says, "Pray for the soul of the dear departed," and then someone's name. very Catholic idea, pray for the dead. Yeah. Well, how did that get in, and how did that get past the whoever allows these things? Well, the answer is because by the back door, various doctrines which are not consistent with the Church of England have been allowed to flourish, and that's exactly the strategy with the Living in Love and Faith stuff. And we longed actually that there would be a good, true kind of regaining of Protestant faith in the Church of England. We long for that and pray for that, and we're very pleased to, you know, support people like Lee Gatiss and Church Society and others who are really, you know, hoping for that. But actually, it's compromised, it seems to me. So I've got some sympathy with a king. He's head of a church which has already, at some way, embraced elements of Catholicism, and he's trying to represent these other people. How else is he supposed you know, represent and be head of state of Hindus on Diwali? I don't know. So yeah, it reveals to me why I'm an independent.
Yeah.
I have some sympathy with the king.
There we go.
You heard it here first.
It's a challenge, isn't it? Because I mean, Prince Charles, when he was Prince Charles, was well known for being his ecumenical. All religions basically lead to God. He wanted to be defender of faiths, not defender of faith.
He said that very clearly.
So kind of what his own personal conviction is clearly that different religions are essentially the same, and there's a difference between engaging with the Pope or Hinduism or Islam and basically taking the view that we're all essentially the same.
And actually
being clear that I don't agree with you, I think you're wrong, but yet I defend your right to practice your religion. So there's a defense of religious freedom for everyone, which is different from saying that although we're totally different in what we believe, essentially we're really all the same. I think navigating that is quite complex. And in relation to the visit to the Vatican, both the Pope and the King ended up exchanging knighthoods with each other. So the Pope was made a knight in Britain, and King Charles received a papal knighthood.
Enough titles already.
There's a right and proper place for a respectful dialogue with people with whom you disagree, acknowledging that you disagree. That is very different from pretending that you're the same. So I think how you navigate those is quite significant. I think this is a relevant issue for us as evangelicals at the moment, because the evidence that's coming out of the Quiet Revival report has shown a significant growth in Catholicism, in this renewal of spirituality, particularly amongst Gen Z.
There is
a move back, not just to Christianity, but to actually Roman Catholicism, to ritual, mysticism, the Mass. So there's a lot of attraction to the historical nature of the church. And actually we see amongst evangelicals an increasing interest in the early church fathers, in confessions, in Thomas Aquinas as a kind of a leading theologian that people seem to be following, despite the fact that Thomas Aquinas underwrites the entire false sacramental system of the Catholic Church. But he's taken now as being the authority that we are meant to listen to. And I think there is... We're seeing some people drift back to a kind of a more of a Catholic way of living in action. I think as those who are Protestants and evangelicals, we need to counter that and recognize that that's not consistent with what the Bible teaches, that the reformers were right to recognize that doctrines had become corrupted. I think the evangelicals were right to go even further than that and begin to recover the vital importance of individual faith and personal conversion. And there's a danger that that is lost by just thinking that these things are all the same. So I think that this is a battle that will need to be fought again. It seems to me we're in a moment not unlike in the 19th century when the Oxford movement under Cardinal Newman and others, Keble, began to look back to Roman Catholicism as a more authentic and more real form of Christianity. And our forebears like J.C. Ryle and others adamantly opposed that because the Roman Catholic Church had not reformed. And I think we're probably in a similar period in which we need to re-engage in that way.
No doubt we'll speak again on those things. A couple of minutes left, brothers.
Have you got time? I've got a candle to light.
Yeah, okay.
That was a joke.
Yeah, of course.
Phil, yeah.
Let's talk
scented candle.
Let's talk about one of our great comic actors who's passed away this week, Prunella Scales, known for Fawlty Towers, particularly.
Not just a comic actor.
No. But that's how she's being remembered.
Yeah.
And she would always say, reading obituaries, that was the role that she loved playing. Sybil Fawlty.
Define
it defined her. Died at the age of 93. She was known in later life for the Channel 4 series Great Canal Journeys, which she did with her late husband, Timothy West. And without sort of going into her life and career, it was a wonderful story of a long marriage.
It was.
With a husband caring for his wife. She had vascular dementia in the final years of her life.
That's right. And it's wonderful to see. I think the beauty of that series, I watched some of that series, very slow moving, as canal boats are. And it was a bit like the Gone Fishing series with Mortimer and Whitehouse. It's just sort of very gentle TV that explores something very precious. So that the Gone Fishing series explores friendship, I think. This series, I think, explored, you know, a very caring relationship between a famous husband and a famous wife. Famous marriages often don't last. They don't stand the test of, you know, the pressure of scrutiny and all that kind of thing.
More than 60 years they were married. Yeah.
So a lovely long marriage. And it just reminds us, actually, we do believe in common grace. So a lovely long marriage. And actually, in later years, a deep care that had to be exercised, I think, because Prunella Scales got so ill. And you began to see her deterioration on screen on the canal journey she was on. She would get confused. She would need help. She would need guidance. And just seeing the care that was offered to her, I found very, very moving, very moving. But also just a reminder that dementia and associated illnesses are a significant part of our broken humanity. And we have to deal with those in very, you know, they can be very painful and difficult. I think of a husband and wife where, you know, for example, the spouse doesn't recognize the other spouse or starts getting aggressive towards the other spouse, and they have to be kept apart. And so there's some very painful pastoral situations behind these things. And I don't think as leaders, we give that enough care and thought. You know, we want to pass to everyone in our churches, including those who are getting elderly, including those who are struggling with dementia, or indeed caring. There's a kind of you grieve before death, I think, when someone that you love has dementia. And it's a really, really important area. We'll put a link on the show notes to Faith in Later Life. It's a wonderful little charity who are doing a lot of work in this area. I think it is important for us to think about, and it is important for us to think about how we care for people well in church.
John?
I think that's right. And actually, we've seen that in our own local church, haven't we? A number of people who've had sort of parents who've suffered dementia, and all through the stages of the onset of dementia through to the point where they can no longer cope on their own. And actually, it's just all consuming to people and their lives. And I think actually, they feel a sort of just that deep grief, but also often a guilt about what they're able to do. And I think we need as churches to be looking after the carers as well. Taking care of them and having a proper.
In fact, that's often the best thing to do is to care for the carers.
But just back to where we started, I think actually it's interesting. It is 50 years since Fawlty Towers, which was her great kind of role. And I think if you go back and watch Fawlty Towers, some of it is remarkably funny. But it also reminds you how much the world has changed since then. And I think we're in a moment at which, again, for a lot of people, they seem to look back to the past and think that was a better time. We would rather go back to that. There are a couple of episodes of Fawlty Towers that can't be shown because they're actually deeply racist.
And would never get made today.
In the way they were commented, will not get made today. And actually, it is good that we are no longer straightforwardly kind of racist in that way of how we characterise people and speak about people. And I think at one level, it is a snapshot of Britain in the mid-1970s. And it's good to be reminded how much things have changed, and in many ways have changed in a much more positive way.
Torquay hotels, have they changed? Come and find out, Phil.
Rising Lights. What a great place to finish. Prunella Scales has died at the age of 93. And I believe she was watching Fawlty Towers a couple of days before she died. Just wonderful. Right. Yeah. Some of it is wonderfully, wonderfully funny. Thank you for joining us for a dive into the news of this past couple of weeks. I hope you found this helpful as you lead your church. And we ask and pray that you would pray for us as we move towards the Leaders' Conference with all that's ahead of us. So thanks for tuning in. It's been good to be with you, brothers. Thank you for talking about the news. And if you've liked it, do rate or leave a review so others can find it. God bless.